It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. This is episode 94, Johnny Guitar. Johnny Guitar is a 1954 film directed by Nicholas Ray and starring Joan Crawford and Sterling Hayden. And we have a sterling panel of wonderful humans to talk about this movie, starting with, let's see, who should we start with? Randy Dittinga. Hi, how are you?
You know, I'd greet you, but I don't shake hands with a left-handed draw. Thought you should know.
Good policies. Appreciate that. Nathan Alderman is also here. Hi.
Hi. I'd greet you, but I'm too busy playing piano in my dramatically empty casino in a huge, floofy white dress, as one does.
And you look fetching, let me tell you. Mickey Maynard is also with us. Hi.
Hi. Well, I would greet you, but I'm looking for a pop of color to go with my tight Western shirt and pants.
Nobody's greeting me, but everybody has style, which I think is a metaphor for this film, if ever there was one. This is a very unusual film, or was, especially at the time it was made. And a lot of contemporary critics in the United States were not fans of it, but it was very much adopted by European directors, Truffaut and folks like that. They're Japanese directors who revere this film. So it's one of those films from the 50s that has had a modern reappraisal, and we'll talk about that. But let me begin with my usual question about our backgrounds with this movie. Mickey, have you seen Johnny Guitar before?
No, and I'm actually a little bit of a Joan Crawford fan. I've read her autobiography, which I somehow got an autographed copy of. I had never seen this movie. I always thought it would probably be super, super campy, and it's pretty campy. So the first time I watched it was in preparation for this show.
Randy, how about you? You have some film noir background, and there are elements of this movie that very definitely remind me of noir anyways.
Yeah, I've seen it before. It's been quite a while. But I'm just really struck by how this is kind of a bizarro Western. The women are in charge. The landscape barely matters. And the only thing that really centers me is that Mercedes McCambridge plays a butch character. I'm like, oh, now I feel at home. This is where I belong.
And as we discussed before the show, but you won't know that because we're not publishing a bootleg tonight. Nathan Alderman, you saw this for the first time fairly recently. Am I right?
Oh, no. No, I rewatched it today. Having mixed it up with the next movie that we're doing. But but I originally saw it about 20 years ago, and I'd read about it, I think, maybe back in high school or college. And I'd wanted to see it for years, like a bizarro 1950s Western where the women were the leads and the men were in secondary roles. That sounded really cool. And it was actually the first Joan Crawford movie I ever saw. This is I've now seen two whole Joan Crawford movies.
Thanks to this show, apparently. Wow, that is definitely. That is. I don't know if I've met anybody who's only seen two Joan Crawford movies. Of course, I hang out with a bunch of classic film nerds. So what can I tell you? Well, I have seen this once before in full consciousness. I think the first time I saw it, perhaps in high school or college, I might have fallen asleep, probably because Westerns are not my thing, and probably because I was also very young and probably didn't appreciate the interesting qualities about this movie. But it was a movie with people in hats, whether they be female or whether they be male. And I guess at 20 years old, I wasn't, you know, so much into that. But I saw this.
What do you have against hats, Shelley?
Do you know me at all? I love hats. I wear them constantly. But I saw this a year or so ago and really did appreciate it, I think, in the way that we're meant to, sort of as modern audiences. And like, oh, look at the things Joan Crawford is doing in this movie. And also Mercedes McCambridge, who I find endlessly fascinating. Hadn't really thought of doing it for the show because it just hadn't occurred to me. It wasn't that I was against doing it, but I think we were having a Joan Crawford conversation at some point, and that's how this movie ended up on the agenda, because I was like, which of Joan Crawford's post-Mildred Pierce movies shall we do? And I heard myself say, Johnny Guitar, and there was universal acclaim. So that's why we're here, and I'm happy we are, because it's a very interesting movie. Nicholas Ray is the director of In a Lonely Place, which we've done, and also Rebel Without a Cause, which we have not. So he's certainly somebody who's known for fairly unusual or striking films, but very different than this one. This movie happened because Joan Crawford bought the rights to the novel, and she went to Nicholas Ray, and they shopped it around to, and ended up at Republic Studios. Republic Studios mostly made westerns and serials very inexpensively in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, but they would have occasional prestige pictures, prestige for them, meaning that you had a budget of like $2 million. So this movie was by no means an expensive movie to make, but by Republic standards, it was. And I confess that whenever I have seen this, I'm always startled that I remember that it's a Republic picture, because I think I'm going to see singing cowboys or, you know, Superman cartoons or something. And I am not. I'm going to see this movie, which is whatever you may think of the sets and the minimalism of it. There's certainly a lot of stylized activity going on, the stylized way of directing the film that Nicholas Ray applied. So it was unusual as a Republic film. It was unusual as a Western. And the reaction at the time, as I said, in the U.S. was a lot of confusion, I think. I think the New York Times, or was it the New Yorker, called it a fiasco. Bosley Crowther, who, of course, doesn't like anything that we like today, was very uncomplimentary of it. There were, as you might imagine, plenty of people who didn't like to see Joan Crawford in pants or in the male role. The idea that women were in charge in this movie and really the driving force behind the movie. It's not even so much that they're in charge, but that they're the driving force in this movie really seemed to make critics of the 50s uncomfortable, as you can imagine. And I have to think that that pleased Nicholas Ray on some level. So I'll just stop talking now, and I'd love to hear sort of your top line reactions. What did you think of Johnny Guitar?
So my top line reaction was that Joan Crawford reminded me of Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada. You don't see Joan Crawford get hysterical. You don't. You know, Miranda Priestly never raises her voice in The Devil Wears Prada. Joan Crawford is running this casino, whatever bar thing, and she doesn't really raise her voice. I mean, there's that someone says about her, I've never seen a woman who acted more like a man, which is true. I mean, she's tough. She's got her own gun holster over her, you know, her black outfit with the pop of color. This is 1954, though, and The Devil Wears Prada comes out 50 years later. So I think this is very, very much ahead of its time.
One of the bizarro angles of the movie is how much Joan Crawford is older than the men she has dalliances with. I think Sterling Hayden was in his late 30s, and I can't think of his name.
Scott Brady.
I think was 29, and she was about 48.
50. And yeah. Well, it depends on which year you.
Oh,
take.
When she was 50-ish. Born.
Yeah, 50-ish.
Yeah. And she's portrayed not as well. I was thinking about a movie we've done before on this podcast, The Best of Everything, which was filmed just a few years later, where she's in her mid-50s and painted as kind of this dried up woman because she's not married. And here she's portrayed as a really a vigorous, a sexy, bold woman. And that goes completely against the Hollywood of that time and our time, that a woman of around 50 is getting younger men, and it's not because she's crazy in some way or a cougar. That's just who she is.
Well, she is at, if not the top of her power, she has a lot more power in 1954 than she does in 1959. Those few years do make a difference, and also just she's closer to the hits that she had in the second half of her career. And I mean, she bought and got this movie made, so she had the ability to create a character that she wanted to play. And in fact, she insisted that the screenwriters beef it up, which you can imagine. I mean, if you're going to buy a screenplay or buy a novel and turn it into a screenplay that you're going to star in, it wouldn't be surprising in the least that you would beef up that character. And I think Sterling Hayden, he's considerably younger than she is, but he doesn't play as a callow person at all. You don't really, I mean, you know, I looked it up, of course I did, but I don't have a lot of fault with the casting. If you had found an actor of that era who was 50, I'm not exactly sure who you would have gotten. And I think Joan Crawford, because she, I mean, most male stars of her stature were doing the same thing. They had much younger women as they got older. They didn't want to be seen with women of their own age. And so if you have the power, I guess you pick an attractive partner who also hopefully won't see, steal scenes from you.
I believe that's known as the DiCaprio effect.
Maybe so.
There's a couple of movies I want to bring up, which are sort of this older, you know, midlife Hollywood women, I guess is a good way to put it. So one is Indiscreet, which is Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. And one of them is An Affair to Remember, which is Cary Grant and Deborah Carr. And then there's another one that I want to bring up, which is called Aimez-vous Brahms in French, and it was called Goodbye Again in English. So all these movies are women in sort of midlife, and they're all dressed in very fluffy, meringue-looking clothes. And in all of them, the men are trying to be in charge of the relationships, although in Indiscreet, Ingrid Bergman figures out what Cary Grant is up to, you know, but in all of them, gorgeous clothes, jewelry, scarves, you know, lush music and that kind of stuff. And then you have this, and I was going to say it's like a Gap ad versus anything like a Hollywood movie, but it's clearly not what was happening in, you know, in the 50s with male and female roles. It's really an outlier.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting is that for the other female lead in the movie, Crawford did not want Mercedes Cambridge was not her choice or not her first choice at all. She wanted Bette Davis or Barbara Stanwyck. Her third choice would have been Claire Trevor. Of the three, I think Claire Trevor would have been a tremendous choice. I think Mercedes McCambridge is great. And the reason I bring that up now is just because just as the dynamic of the lead actress and her male co-star is important and interesting, I think how she would have cast the part, which is her adversary, female adversary, is interesting too. Crawford and Davis either did or didn't have a terrible feud for their whole entire life, depending on what book you've read. But certainly by the time they make Whatever Happened to Baby Jane in the early 60s, they're dining out on the fact that they don't get along, or they're playing it up, or they're allowing that to benefit their performances in the film one way or another. I don't relish the idea of Crawford and Stanwyck fighting. I think that just would have been poor casting. Stanwyck would have been better in the Crawford role, if you ask me. She could have played the Mercedes McCambridge role, but not with as much sort of astringence and as much sulfuric acid, I think, is the way somebody described Mercedes McCambridge's performance, which I kind of like that description. And then Claire Trevor is just like this, who we saw last in Key Largo, mm-hmm. and who I really like. I think she's an underrated actress because she has... She's very elastic in her the kinds of performances she can do. I mean, you can think of a lot of Claire Trevor performances and you can think, well, she's not strong enough to have played the Mercedes McCambridge part, or she's just not of has enough substance. But I actually think she does. I think she would have been really interesting. But those choices from Crawford feels like the Bette Davis thing would have been accentuating the fact that these two women hate each other, and that it's much more about their relationship than it is about the relationships that either of them have with the men in the movie.
One thing interesting, you brought up Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and I was curious about how IMDb users rated this movie in the Joan Crawford oeuvre, and so I checked it out. The highest rated movie on IMDb of Joan Crawford movies is Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, followed by Mildred Pierce, The Women, and then Johnny Guitar among her major movies. So this is really, you know, one of fans think this is one of her very top three or four movies.
Well, there's a hardness to Joan Crawford that's always been there, and it's difficult, even especially in Mildred Pierce, it's difficult to see her try to play soft because that's just clearly not who she is. She is hard and tough. There is, you know, you look at her face and it's all like hard angles. There's not a lot of softness or you know, roundness to any of her features. And, you know, she accentuates that with her costumes, with the square shoulders. And I'm not trying to say that it's like a pejorative. It works so well for the character and the performance here. As long as she's not, and occasionally she does seem to do a lot of acting by flaring her eyes. But when she's not doing that, she's really giving a good, deep, interesting performance here. And Mercedes McCambridge, holy cow. It's like if Judy Garland was a fascist pyromaniac. I could not take my eyes off her. And, you know, Crawford is acting with her eyes. McCambridge acts with her teeth like Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, she's so good. I love her. I think she's perfect in the role because of the sort of unhinged and acerbic nature of the way she plays it. I think she has such good notes. Now, McCambridge, apparently, she and Crawford didn't get along. I'm sure we'll get to all the details of that.
Everyone in this movie hated everyone else.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right. But I think whether the real life feelings fueled it or not, I just feel like the tension between those two characters is palpable. And I think it helps not only their relationship or lack thereof in the movie, but as I was saying, I think it really drags the movie's focus in general toward the women. And it's not just, oh, let's have women have powerful roles. Let's be feminist in the way that we talk about women, except when we're, you know, calling them men, which is a criticism in the 1950s. But let's make them so much the center of the action and the attention of the movie that you kind of don't care what happens to the dudes, to be honest. They're just not, they're there and they're watching Emma and Vienna tussle in this, you know, life or death struggle, literally. But none of the men really matter all that much.
No.
Not even Emma's brother. Yeah. Emma's brother gets killed in the holdup, but we barely even see his body. He's just a side, not even a side story. He's just off stage.
Is Emma McIver's daughter?
I don't think so.
So she's just some random lady in the town who bosses everybody around by sheer psychotic force of will. That's interesting.
I wonder about that too.
So 2 years after this movie comes out, Mercedes McCambridge plays Luz in Giant. So Bick Benedict, is that his name?
Bick Benedict. Yeah.
Yeah, the guy that
Rock Hudson character.
Elizabeth Taylor marries. Okay, Leslie. So she's his sister. She's running the ranch. She's, you know, directing the servants in the kitchen and all that. And she's just as dykey, I guess I can say, in that movie as she is in this one. But she is only in that movie for a little while, which I think is very interesting that I think she could have been a very compelling character in Giant. And they off her pretty quickly, like within the first act of the movie. And it was kind of like here she got to go full steam, the full movie in this very complex character. And in Giant, she only got, you know, one or two scenes, essentially, playing almost the same role.
I think the same thing about Giant. I saw it probably a year and a half ago because I'm trying to decide whether we should do Giant, which we probably will at some point. But I remember thinking the very same thing. I had forgotten that she was in it because I had seen Giant before. And then I watched it and I was like, oh, Mercedes McCambridge is in this and she's awesome. Where'd she go?
And they kill her off. Spoiler, yep. Spoiler alert. They kill
spoiler
her off.
Spoiler alert, yeah. For Giant.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting how she ended up being coded as this kind of butch lesbian character, which she played in a couple of other roles. In a Touch of Evil, she's this butch biker type character who is just getting turned on by Janet Leigh being drugged up in a motel room.
And, that part was so creepy.
Yeah, and then she's also in All the King's Men in this kind of political advisor position, but she dresses very manly and it is coded is gay, at least from the modern eye, and I'm just curious how she ended up in that lane. Who looked at her and thought, you know, this we got to dress up her in kind of manlier clothes and really butch her up and not give her a lot in terms of male relationships.
But what's fascinating is how good she is at it. Like, she doesn't feel like she's been forced into a role. That she does it with vigor and with gusto, just where, as they always said about Bette Davis, that when they gave her a role that required her to look less than her best or behave in a way that was less than dignified, that Davis relished it. I don't know how McCambridge felt about it, although she was quite a serious actor. I believe she had some, was part of the Method group at one point. She worked with Orson Welles. She's got this long, interesting career, but all the parts she plays seem to be, at the very least, heavily character parts, and at most is what you're saying. She does do sort of a lot of butch parts, so much so that I've read various things that say she was a lesbian. She was married a couple times, which I realize doesn't mean anything, but a couple of the things I was reading to prep for this say that she was not, in fact, a lesbian. I don't know that we know that. She was suffering from severe alcoholism at the time she made this movie, and in fact said later that it impacted her experience on the movie and probably contributed to her part of the feud with Crawford, although Crawford is absolutely not blameless and doing things like going and ransacking McCambridge's cabin and throwing her clothes out in the street and that sort of thing. Yeah. And it's an odd thing because, you know, you think of the stereotype of female feuds is that somehow the other person is getting more attention or being treated more flatteringly. And Ray and Crawford were apparently having an affair at the time, not McCambridge and Crawford, although Crawford had dated McCambridge's former husband, so there was some bad blood there. But it wasn't like two divas trying to out-diva each other in the traditional sense. So it's really kind of fascinating that they didn't get along.
Remember when we did our silent sampler? I was just thinking about why Europe would like this movie so much. And Mercedes McCambridge feels very much like one of those silent movie characters in the Louise Brooks movies. And, you know, very almost Germanic, kind of that Berlin, that tawdry.
Like the boarding school.
Yeah.
Headmistress or the prison matron.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, they're over in European cinema, they're used to people like this. And we weren't. I mean, we made everything kind of lovey-dovey. And yeah, I mean, I know there's the celluloid closet, but this should be in it, but this is not a movie you necessarily think of for that. And so I could definitely see why this would fit in with a European sensibility versus the 50s American sensibility.
No, I didn't read McCambridge as gay, but one, my gaydar is just irreparably broken, and two, there's so much queerness as just background radiation in this movie. It's like everyone in this movie is hot for everyone else.
Or not at all, because there's the whole story about, the dancing kid. Is he Joan Crawford's ex-boyfriend, or is he Mercedes McCambridge? Does she, you know, Joan Crawford says she basically is in love with him, but she can't. But Mercedes can't stomach the fact that she is in love with him. It makes her uncomfortable and insecure about herself. And I'm like, I buy that as a sort of a subtext, but I don't see it in the sort of chemical attributes of the actors. I don't feel much male-female chemistry in general in this movie, and especially not between McCambridge and Scott Brady.
Oh, yeah. No, that he looks like dime store Lawrence Tierney.
Well, it's his brother.
Really?
He's literally Lawrence Tierney's brother.
Really?
That there makes so much sense. I was like, wait a minute, that's not Lawrence Tierney? Yeah, and Lawrence Tierney, who in turn looks like Giga Chad Humphrey Bogart.
we'll do a Lawrence Tierney here somewhere. We'll do Born to Kill, which is I have trouble watching that movie, but it's so good.
And well, also part of the problem is that the dancing kid never dances.
No, I know. Well,
if he'd only dance.
But the dancing kid is very interested in seeing how Sterling Hayden handles his pistol. That's all I'm saying. There's a definite vibe there.
You know, I'll go with you on that. I actually buy that.
And there's a definite vibe between Crawford and McCambridge. It's almost like the dancing kid is just like a proxy for McCambridge's crazed obsession with Crawford.
Right. I agree with that. I do think that's the most interesting relationship, whether it's love, hate, love, or pure hate, what, however you want to define it, however much queerness you want to apply to it, that relationship is the heart of the movie, the beating bloody heart of the movie.
I love Nicholas Ray films because he always digs into his character's psychology and finds such interesting things. And I mean, I think the plotting in this movie is kind of dumb. The dancing kid and his gang decide to hold up a bank because reasons. But I love the characterization in this film. I love the way they give little moments like to the guy who helps out Vienna in her kitchen and you know, dies and is like, you know, finally everyone's paying attention to me, or the tubercular guy in the dancing kid's gang, or Turkey, the young kid, or even Ernest Borgnine playing yet another in his long string of total dirtbags.
Ernest Borgnine heaving himself onto the horse.
This was so early in his career. He's going to make Marty and win an Oscar in a year. And so I looked at, I recognized him right away, of course, but I looked at him and I couldn't help thinking, oh, that's young Ernest Borgnine. Wait, that doesn't scan at all. I'm so confused now.
I was just seeing him as the same dirtbag he played in Bad Day at Black Rock.
Yeah, kind of. But yeah, I like the supporting parts. I think all of those actors are, I mean, there are a lot of them are Western veterans. You've got your Ward Bonds and your John Carradines and that sort of thing. And they fill out the cast nicely. I do think the sort of most inexplicable part is the, you know, all of the bank rob, the alleged stagecoach robbers who then become bank robbers, and all of the stuff with them trying to get away and everything. And I understand why you need that set of characters, but I kind of wasn't as nearly as interested in them as I am in the Vienna Emma tussle.
You know, I always go to the bank. I always go to the bank during funerals.
The line is shorter.
The lines are shorter. I do the same thing with Costco. I really do.
Yeah, the free samples are so much better during a funeral.
I want to mention that I'm the one who always looks to see who's still alive from the cast.
No, nobody, Randy, no.
Nobody. And then they die. You know, I'm the Grim Reaper here, but no one is still alive. But one actor did just die about 4 years ago, and that was Ben Cooper, who played Turkey and somehow managed to make a bright yellow shirt work in a Western.
I kind of enjoyed him, actually. Yeah, I thought it was a good performance. So Sterling Hayden, let's talk about him a little bit. As we mentioned, he's considerably or somewhat younger than Joan Crawford, although, as I say, I think he's, to me, he scans older. Hayden had come up as sort of a pretty boy way back before he went into the Army during World War II. And he came out, I don't think he was wounded or anything, but he came out looking more rugged. And so he was less, I mean, even though he's, you know, he's handsome, he's blonde and all that stuff, but he comes out being a much more rugged guy than a pretty boy guy. And I think that absolutely works for this part, not because he's necessarily the toughest guy in the room, but because I don't know, I can sort of buy that he and Joan Crawford had this sort of gruff thing going on, but it was never any more emotional than it is in that scene where she's like, say you love me. Okay, I love you and stuff. And I sort of imagine their whole relationship being that way.
Yeah, he's kind of like if John Lund had just enough charisma to be serviceable. He's in the movie to be large and
poor
have a deep
John
voice,
Lund. Oh,
and that's
my God.
About it. Look, I mean, I recently rewatched, like a few years ago, I rewatched The Mating Season with Gene Tierney and Thelma Ritter. And I had forgotten that John Lund was even in that movie, and he's the male lead. So, you know, I'm sorry. There's nothing that John Lund cannot be saved.
Looking for John Lund movies now. No. Yeah, I want to like, and some of the reappraisals of Johnny Guitar give Hayden credit, and I think what they're really giving him credit for is how he and Crawford interact in those scenes where they're by themselves. And I tried. I really tried to say, okay, well, am I not appreciating him? Is his performance better than I think it is? Is it more interesting in some way, even if it's not a great bit of acting? And I don't know. I think he's well cast. Let me put it that way. But I just don't. I don't dig the performance. And again, though, if you want to argue that this movie is really supposed to be about Joan Crawford and Mercedes McCambridge, maybe it's fine. It's just fine. Yeah, you could have brought John Lennon. Although I like Hayden well enough, but I don't love him as an actor.
He's got a few good moments of bemusement, but like you never really get the sense, and it's a really interesting idea in the screenplay, that this guy will not pick up a gun because if he picks up a gun, he will not put it down until everyone else is dead. That's that never registers in his performance. I think just because he was miserable and like fighting with Crawford and fighting with his soon to be ex-wife and just wanted to get paid and go home. And that very much reads in his performance.
He was known as an actor who thought of acting as a job, not as a calling or a mission something grander. This was just a job I did and then I went home. But
that comes through.
I was more struck in terms of wondering whether I was wondering about the performance with Scott Brady. He really kind of came across as a John Lund to me at first, and then eventually he grew on me during the performance. But he didn't come across as much of an actor or much of a character.
No, I was just thinking about All That Heaven Allows, because, you know, if you look at Jane Wyman and Rock Hudson, who acted with passion for each other. I mean, I'm bringing that up because I think the inside of the casino looks a little bit like the barn that Rock Hudson.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean?
I get it.
Yeah, the barn with the big window and the deer walks by. Yeah. And so I was kind of in my head, I was comparing their chemistry with this chemistry. And Rock Hudson acted chemistry much better than this.
1,000,000%.
There's also this.
I don't know. I thought he had a really wooden performance in that movie, which made sense because he was a logger.
Yes, I also agree with you. And yet, I would still take Rock Hudson's performance over Sterling Hayden's here.
Yeah. And I think Sterling Hayden was really just not enjoying this whole shoot because apparently he said something like, there's not enough money in Hollywood to make me do another picture with Joan Crawford. And I like money.
That casino set, though, is fantastic. There are so many great touches. The rock wall at the back makes such a striking backdrop for the piano. And then Vienna has a model of where the railroad is going to come in and the town that she's going to build. She knows that everyone else in town hates her for this. And she's got a model out there to be like, yeah, look at it in despair, jerks. I love it.
Well, and stuff gets thrown all the time. There's a whole bunch of glass getting thrown inside the casino hotel ski lodge thing. And it, you know, at some point she throws an oil lamp, but then
nothing happens.
And it takes the giant chandelier coming down for the place to get to go up in flames. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, what happened to the oil lamp?
That scene with McCambridge casually aiming the shotgun, like looking up at the chandelier, casually aiming the shotgun, letting it drop, watching the kerosene spread and just smiling, like halfway holding up her arms like some sort of angel of death, is just so bonkers. It's great.
There's kind of a Wizard of Oz feel to it where the Wicked Witch of the West is, I'm melting, and the whole place is going up in flames and there's hardly any reaction. I mean, this is her dream home casino ski lodge and they're just out there going, all right, I guess we got to get away now.
I guess one reason that the scenes in that ski lodge, let's just call it a ski lodge. It makes me happier to say than a casino. I guess it's a casino. It's a saloon, whatever. But the only people who ever come are people who mean Vienna ill, it seems like. Yeah. It's not one of those Westerns where it's filled out with a bunch of extras and a guy and a player piano and a bunch of drunks at the bar or whatever. It's only ever the people who have some commerce to do with Vienna, which I think is, the sort of desolation of the whole Sedona environment and the fact that like when Sterling Hayden first comes at the beginning of the movie, he rides through a dust storm and his is the only horse at the hitching post and there's nobody in there except Vienna and the people who work for her and the railroad guy. I mean, it just feels like there's nobody in this town except the actors that they've hired to play these actual parts. They couldn't even afford extras or they just decided they didn't make, I guess Nicholas Ray probably didn't want them. I guess he could have had extras if he had wanted them, but there really aren't any.
But there's the posse that comes in and then suddenly you have like two entire football teams in this casino and all of them are standing around doing nothing. It's weird.
Right. And I think the casino ski lodge, whatever, is a set, right? It's not in Sedona. So
there are close-ups of Joan Crawford.
Right.
So yes, it's a set.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Because the rest of it is, and there's a really cool article about basically, and it reminds me of all the stories of when Giant came to Marfa, Texas. But it's like when this movie company came to Sedona, which actually had a fair number of movies made in it, I think. But there's just a lot of good material about what an interesting lot of people. Apparently, Joan Crawford was nice to some people and not nice to some other people. And as film crews will be, they probably tore up the town a little bit.
I was really surprised by how little the scenery plays a role in the movie. There, you know, there's so many movies that we watch for this podcast where the setting is a major character. But here, other than kind of there's really long scenes of horses going places, but there's never really an appreciation of the scenery, of the which is fantastic around Sedona. They don't really take advantage of it. I kind of wonder why... Ray made that choice, why he didn't play it up, but because it comes across as more like it's not grand. It's not a movie on a grand physical scale of the West.
There's that striking opening shot where Sterling Hayden rides into frame, and then the entire mountain behind him explodes. Mm-hmm. And then there's that sequence later where like Nicholas Ray is like blowing up half of Sedona, like it's a Michael Bay film or something. But yeah, I agree with you. Ray, you know, a lot of films, you see them stage bound and they feel like a play, and that's a bad thing. But here, all the best scenes do feel like a play, and they feel close and claustrophobic, and that's what you need for the pressure cooker of characters and conflicts. Whenever it gets outdoors, it gets boring. You feel like Ray cares a lot more about the indoor scenes than he does about the Western of it all, and he's just kind of going through the motions. Okay, guys, now you ride your horses this way, and whatever, I guess.
Yeah, ride through the waterfall a couple times. The waterfall, which is apparently like water diverted from a highway. It isn't a real waterfall.
And the stylized dialogue that is used throughout the movie works certainly much better inside. And I think when you're outside, that doesn't happen as much unless the main characters, unless Crawford and McCambridge are bellowing at each other. But both, mostly those scenes work best when they're inside and when characters are close enough that they can say these clipped lines and then wait for the other character to say his or her clipped line and do a little physical bit of business. And it's just, I think that's part of what appealed to the European sensibility, too, was that it wasn't sort of sentimental or story heavy. It was more about the style of the way people spoke to each other and the sort of thrust and parry of, you know, I'm mad at you and I'm mad at you and what are you going to do about it and blah, blah, blah. All the way from when Johnny first comes in and he has his first conflict, you know, all the way to the end. You could argue that McCambridge and Crawford have a slightly different style than whenever they're interacting with, especially Crawford, with the men, because they're more sort of down and dirty, down to earth or whatever. But it all is still quite stylized in a way that you might expect in a noir or some other movie that's not like a 1950s melodrama.
And this could have easily been a noir.
Yes.
I mean, the musician who blows into town to a casino where, you know, the nightclub singer that he used to know has now, you know, set up a cushy land deal for herself and all the local high rollers want her out of town. It didn't have to be a Western, and it's weird that it was.
How does a guitar survive without a case out there in the desert? I just want to know that.
And Sterling Hayden couldn't play guitar and apparently couldn't ride a horse, so he was really well cast here.
Yeah, he only plays guitar that one time, or he is seen to be playing guitar only that one time. It's like, okay, I've earned my nickname, I'm done.
But it, for all that, it really is chilling to see the mob get their way, to see, you know, McCambridge whip up this posse into a frenzy, and to see her get Ward Bond to go along with her, to see her kill the marshal in cold blood and nobody bats an eye about it so that she can murder two other people. There's a suffocating, claustrophobic feeling that comes in, especially around the lynching scene, that really does kind of chill you. It's the lynching scene is the one outdoor scene that really horrifies you. And you don't even see what happens to Turkey. You don't even hear anything. It's all up to your imagination. And it's horrible.
Yes, very much so. It is. And you kind of think, because that happens so far into the movie, it's one of those scenes where you kind of think you know what the layers of the movie are and what you can expect from it. And then that at least startled me when I saw it again, having not seen it in many, many years. And I think I expected a little more this time when I watched it today. But when I saw it, a year or so ago, I was just like, oh, that I didn't see that coming, which I guess you can argue is, suspense is good, right? We like that. But yeah, I agree with you. It's very chilling. And it raises the stakes of the movie in a way that even the previous threats of violence and, burning the place down and all that didn't quite. It takes it to another level, and you have to confront it.
Then they diffuse all that tension later by having the entire posse be suddenly like, no, we're tired of vigilante justice. Let's just let Mercedes McCambridge and Joan Crawford shoot it out. But I did want to say real quick, the line that chills me the most in this movie. So Turkey's been bullied into trying, fingering Joan Crawford as part of his gang in hopes of saving himself from getting lynched. And all he does is just like grunt and nod his head. And then McCambridge says, you heard him. He said it from his own lips. And that assertion of power over reality, just a little too close to home in 2024.
I don't know if anybody has seen Saltburn, but an awful lot happens at the end of Saltburn. And I had the same feeling watching this movie that we've kind of plodded along and had a few things happen. And then all of a sudden it gets very dark at the end when poor Turkey hangs. And then Mercedes and Joan have their shootout. And I thought, I think a more contemporary version of this might have spread the violence out throughout the movie rather than backloading it.
I think the violence makes the political allegories much more explicit. I think it's possible to watch this movie and other Westerns of the 50s that have connections to the House Un-American Activities Committee and all the communist witch hunting that was going on at the time. But I think once you get into violence and why it happens and the justification and whipping the mob up, then I think it becomes difficult to ignore. And it's interesting to me, though, that that is recognized contemporarily, and even probably by the European observers as well, who had just been through a very much more intimate experience of World War II than we had. But it is not in the contemporary criticism really addressed at all. There is a lot of complaint about the movie and, oh, this is weird, and why is Joan Crawford dressed like a man and all that stuff. But there isn't what you would expect in terms of reaction to the political overtones or undertones, I guess, of the violence in the movie, which I think is kind of interesting.
My guess is probably all the critics were just so bamboozled by, why is Lady wearing pants?
Right.
How feminist do you guys think this movie is? It struck me as it calls out the double standard. Joan calls that out. Men can kill and shoot and do whatever they want, and a woman, fools around just once, and then she's branded for life. And that seemed to be, I don't know if you guys seen that message in other movies of the 50s?
Very rarely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like it's feminine-ish. I mean, they never try to make it a bad thing that Joan Crawford has agency and money and power, and they never try to portray her as being like bad at what she does. She's always very good, but they take pains to have her like swan around in a red lacy nightgown going, but no, really, despite all my pants wearing, I'm still hot for you, Sterling Hayden. And then, McCambridge is, 100% internalized misogyny. I feel like it could be more feminist than it is. It's still pretty darn feminist for 1954.
Yeah, that was the feeling that I had too, was when you, especially when you fast forward to The Best of Everything, which has female lead characters and female women in the workplace, and yet the women in the workplace all have these happy endings, except for one, with the men in their lives. And in this movie, it's very clear that Mercedes McCambridge and Joan Crawford are just fine without men to support them. They can tussle this thing out for themselves.
Well, and they have money. We don't find out why Joan Crawford has the money to open this place. We don't really interrogate Mercedes McCambridge about that either, because that a lot of times is something that will either be taken away from a woman, or a woman will be criticized for having money, or they'll make a point to say it was her father's money or something like that. And it feels like the taunting that Joan Crawford gets, whether behind her back or in front of her, about, you know, her being manly or whatever it is, it doesn't feel like that really bothers her. It's the weak men. It's all they got, really, because they are – Mercedes McCambridge and Joan Crawford are kind of running this deal. And there is a point at which, you know, when they're setting the posse up and McIver says to Mercedes Cambridge, you can't go. And Emma – we'll just call her Emma because it's shorter – says to Emma, you can't go. And she says, I'm going to go. And then later on, she attempts to lead them in a direction, and Ward Bond is basically just like, no. No, we're going to do this other thing over here. And so they lose sometimes, but they continue to get to do it in a way that isn't for, you know, a lot of times in a movie like this, you might see a woman be feminist, have a feminist role for maybe a third of the movie, and then she gets slapped down. And for the rest of the movie, she's cowed either because of the love of a good man or just because she can't stand up to the number of men, the fact that she's the only woman in the movie and that there's 37 guys running around and they're going to overwhelm her.
Yeah, there still are only two women in this movie, and they hate each other and are constantly trying to destroy each other. And while I love that the big final shootout is between them, and it is, they're not like, you know, flailing around haplessly. Both of these people are very good shots and know what they're doing. It's still, you know, it can't truly be a feminist film because both of the women are like fighting over dudes and trying to destroy each other.
Well, it doesn't help, but you know, I think for 1954, we always have to put that caveat on, I guess.
Oh yeah.
And I don't think you could absolutely call, you know, Nicholas Ray is not somebody who's known as a super progressive feminist director. The screenwriters, this is one of those where you have ghost screenwriters that were touched by the Blacklist, as well as, you know, a real guy who was out front. But I think a lot of the behind the scenes stuff was done by Ben Maddow, who was, if not blacklisted, he was threatened with blacklisting. That's why I'm being careful, because I'm not sure exactly how far. I know he's dead and he can't come back and hurt me, but I'm not sure exactly how far the suspicion went against him. But I don't know whether that sensibility would have contributed to a more feminist reading, or whether it was Joan Crawford, who, of course, not only owned the project, but had made changes that would make her character stronger, or at least more, you know, if she had more stuff to do in the movie. So I guess I don't know who you can lay the credit for whatever feminism the movie has, whether it would be Ray or whether screenwriters or Crawford or some combination.
And I would say that it would be interesting to see what this movie would have been like if it had been written by a woman. But The Best of Everything was adapted from a woman's novel by two women, and it's resoundingly anti-feminist, as we previously discussed.
I don't know if it was anti-feminist, as it was. I thought it was more like it really exposed a lot about all what the women had to go through at that time.
It did, but then it was like, and women, this is why you shouldn't work or try to be independent.
Oh, right.
Right, or there's a price to pay for it, and it's a really big one.
Yes, you'll be so much more happy if you just stop all this career nonsense and get married to a drunken man.
Final thoughts about Johnny Guitar.
Well, I just want to say a couple things about the wardrobe and about Joan Crawford's perfect red lip. I thought the clothes, I mean, I love cinema costumes. I just, you know, I really always watch for how everyone is dressed in this. And I thought there were just some really outstanding ones. First of all, Mercedes McCambridge is wearing morning culottes. So that's a divided skirt. If you watch her get on the horse, she's riding astride. She's not riding side saddle as you would in a skirt, if that was an actual skirt. And I thought, I mean, it looks like a skirt, but it's a divided skirt. And I thought that was very cool. I loved some of the things that Joan wore. I mean, Joan kept her figure, you know, religiously most of her life. And so to be able to wear those shirts and trousers and look as, you know, as hot as she did. And then she's got a purple dress at one point that's gorgeous. And then, of course, we have the white dress that she plays on the grand piano in the ski lodge. And
then that was amazing.
What I think was really funny was the one scene where, you know, they run off and they're going to change their clothes. And she puts on a red shirt and blue jeans so she can blend in with the territory as they're trying to escape. And I found that to be really hilarious. And then there's a yellow top that she puts on. But it was, you know, apparently the European fans of this movie say that one thing that really appealed to them was the colors in the movie. And the men are all in black and white. They're all in black coats or black coats with some white trim. And that allows what Joan Crawford is wearing and even what Mercedes McCambridge is wearing to stand out from the crowd, literally.
And meanwhile, Sterling Hayden is costumed in a way to literally blend into the background. He's all browns and earth tones.
He's dust. He's just...
he's dust.
I love that white dress. I have a very low tolerance for camp, but that is just the right amount of camp deployed in just the right way. That the ridiculous, like, diva extraness of, I'm going to play my piano in an empty casino while you all storm in with your posse. The only way that scene could have been better is if Turkey had been hiding underneath the gigantic flounces of her skirt.
I wanted to mention to give a sense of what this time was like in the 50s. There's a we mentioned Bosley Crowther, the New York Times movie critic, and he said of Crawford, quote, "No more femininity comes from her than from the rugged Heflin in Shane. For the lady, as usual, is as sexless as the lions on the public library steps, and as sharp and romantically forbidding as a package of unwrapped razor blades."
So he's saying not only was he not a fan of her and Johnny Guitar, but Joan Crawford is lost on him completely, it seems.
Am I wrong in suggesting that women in general might have been lost on Bosley Crowther?
I think so. Yeah, he was not a fan of Joe Crawford as some of his folks of his persuasion might have been. I don't know.
It says here, I just Googled him, and he had a wife and kids, and you could be correct.
I don't know. You go, Bosley. You're always good for a laugh. I think maybe we should stop every show for a reading of a Bosley Crowther review, because there's some gems in there.
I will forever be in Bosley Crowther's debt for his review of The Fountainhead, so I can't argue with that.
Just like to point out, the number of past LTS episodes we've referenced this time is epic. I appreciate every one of you for your help. I write these down. I don't know why. I'm the only one who cares, but I always put those links in the show notes for you so that you could go back and reference. You've got a lot of homework. Every episode you listen to, there's so many more.
Well, that's why this podcast really is the best of everything.
I like to think so. On that note, thank you, Mickey, Nathan, and Randy, for joining me to talk about Johnny Guitar. We will be back next week with A Place in the Sun. If you'd like to follow this podcast, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can send us an email at lts@theincomparable.com with your feedback or comments. Follow us on the social medias at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Bye now.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.